From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Today at WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, it's Here and Now. The Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to vote later today to send the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, to the full Senate for a full vote, which will likely take place on Friday. Many Democrats, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, are saying they plan to filibuster that vote, which would force Republicans to change the rules if they want to get Gorsuch through. And it sounds like they're ready to do that. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says one way or another, Gorsuch will be confirmed this week. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. And there's never been a real question about whether Judge Gorsuch would get through the Judiciary Committee, given Republicans have a majority of the seats. But did anything you heard today as committee members debated tell you anything new about that vote at the end of the week?
Well, I think the Democrats are trying to really make it clear that they see Gorsuch as someone who would rule against their positions on major cases. And they're also trying to make the case this is not a seat that belongs to Justice Scalia. You know, sometimes in shorthand, it's called Scalia's
seat. You mean Justice Gorsuch?
Yes, you did. Right. Mm-hmm. So Justice Scalia vacated the seat. And so Republicans often call it Scalia's seat as a way of making it seem like having Gorsuch succeed him is a kind of natural course of events. I think Democrats are arguing this is just an open seat. It actually was originally supposed to be filled by Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee. He, of course, did not get through. And so this idea that is this seat truly Merrick Garland's seat? His ghost kind of hangs over these proceedings.
Yeah. And remind us, what's the math? How many Democrats would have to break ranks and vote with Republicans to confirm Gorsuch to avoid that so-called nuclear option rules change, you know, the straight vote? Where are senators on that count?
The Republicans need 60 votes to achieve what's called cloture in the Senate. That means to then bring the nomination to a vote. And there are 48 Democrats. So right now we have 40 Democrats saying for sure that they are in favor of a filibuster. And the question is whether the five people who are undecided, or the eight people who are as yet undecided, what will happen with them? I'm sorry, five undecided, three saying they will vote to get Gorsuch through the vote, and then 40 saying no to Gorsuch.
Well, it gets so confusing because you can say, yes, you will vote to get him through, but then what about the filibuster? How do you stand on that? And what happens if Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and a number of his colleagues filibuster as promised?
If the Democrats filibuster, if they have 41 or more votes in favor of not allowing Gorsuch to the floor, then the Republicans will have to decide whether to do what's called the nuclear option, which is to end the filibuster. And then the Republicans, by a majority vote, could say, we no longer have a filibuster, in other words, a 60-vote threshold for Supreme Court nominees. And then they would just have Gorsuch go to the Senate on an up-and-down majority vote.
Yeah, which is what, 50...
51, right? 51, or 50-50, right. And Mike Pence breaks the tie.
Right, breaks the tie. Well, and what's at stake for each side in this brinksmanship? I mean, I hear from so many people, I understand something serious is going on, and it's like a game of chicken, but what's at stake for each?
Well, so for Republicans, they are very fond of Judge Gorsuch as a nominee. They really like him. They see this as President Trump's biggest achievement so far, his home run. So they want this justice on the Supreme Court. For the Democrats, there is opposing Gorsuch. And then there is this game of chicken, as you say, a kind of blame game between the two parties about the breakdown in bipartisanship that used to be the norm for Supreme Court nominees. And a question of if the Republicans decide on the nuclear option and they end the filibuster, they will try to point the finger at the Democrats and say that the Democrats started this process years earlier. And the Democrats will say, no, 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 this is on you. So there's both a fight over this particular human being, Neil Gorsuch, and then a procedural battle over the Senate and its process for Supreme Court nominees.
And, you know, nobody wants to be responsible for this big change. But why is there such a thing as a nuclear option? You know, why have a filibuster if you can just pull this rules change?
Well, the Senate has traditionally seen itself as the more moderating body, right? The famous phrase is that it's the saucer that cools the tea of Washington, where hot passions kind of come to fall
quickly.
Away. And so the right? And the 60-vote threshold is supposed to help with that. It means that you're more likely to need bipartisan support for a major law or for a Supreme Court decision. And so that's the body's traditional view of itself. And the question is whether it will hold.
Right. Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine, fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Atlanta is getting used to the new traffic landscape today after a section of Interstate 85 collapsed on Thursday, shutting down lanes in both directions. About 220,000 people drive that stretch of highway every day, according to the Georgia Department of Transportation. And it means Atlanta commuters have to find alternative routes in a city already known for traffic congestion. Here's Georgia Transportation spokesperson Natalie Dale speaking last night about what drivers should expect today.
There's no question that the removal and replacement of the I-85 bridge will cause increased travel times, headaches, and a lot of inconvenience. Georgia DOT is committed to replacing and reopening this facility as quickly as possible. We're working swiftly to clear the debris, and we're committed to ensuring a safe, connected transportation network.
Joining us now is Sam Whitehead from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting. Hi, Sam.
Hey there.
And what was the morning commute like today?
Honestly, it was not that bad. There were a lot of predictions of a kind of traffic apocalypse this morning. But a lot of school districts here in the metro area are actually on spring break. So that cut down on a fair bit of traffic on the roads. This is just the first day, though. It's not like this is going to be fixed tomorrow or anytime this week. It's going to be months. So it's really kind of hard to tell right now if today is our new normal or if things are going to somehow continue to get worse over time.
Well, and it sounds like some people in Atlanta have decided that instead of driving, they will take mass transit.
That's correct. So Atlanta does have a transit system, MARTA, we call it here. It won't get you everywhere, but the system is actually pretty solid. And the Georgia DOT and a bunch of other state agencies have actually really been encouraging people to consider transit now because we know there's a problem and transit offers a solution. So I went out this morning to talk to some commuters to kind of get a sense of who might be new to MARTA, who might be riding it for the first time. And I talked to an individual named Eric Kendall. He actually says he imagined what happened in Atlanta with the collapse of this interstate would actually be a big deal anywhere in the country.
People talk about the George Washington Bridge being closed in New York and how that affects traffic. And I'm sure you could find just any city that you take out a big piece of infrastructure like that and it would really affect it. But Atlanta, you know, already notorious for its traffic. And, you know, this just adds to it.
I spoke to a bunch of other writers, many of them using MARTA for the first time, and their perspective on this was, you know, they're kind of going to wait and see if MARTA is a viable option for them. But at least today, they were giving it a shot.
So how long is it expected to take to repair this section of highway?
That is a great question. Right now, it's kind of anybody's guess. So what's currently happening this week is Georgia DOT is working to demolish part of the interstate. So part of it collapsed. That was the northbound lanes, but the southbound lanes were also damaged. And it's really only going to be once Georgia DOT gets those lanes demolished in the southbound side that they kind of have a sense of their timeline. Right now, I'm hearing months. There's no number associated with that, so we don't know if that's 4 months, 6 months, 10 or 11 months, but it's definitely going to be a while.
And what do we know at this point about exactly what caused this to happen?
So the fire, as you mentioned, broke out Thursday afternoon. And where the fire was is actually land that is managed by the State Department of Transportation. They use it for storage. And they say what actually caught fire was kind of high-density cable, the things that they use to set up traffic lights, that kind of thing. And as it turns out, over the weekend, there were three people charged in association with this fire. All of them charged with criminal trespass. It seems there were these three individuals who were under the bridge in this storage site. site on Thursday afternoon. One of them has been charged with first-degree arson, even though that individual claims he left the area before the fire started. Another part of this story is the individual who's been charged did admit to using crack cocaine earlier in the day, so that throws a little bit of a wrinkle potentially in his story. But right now, it's still just at the very early stages of figuring out specifically what happened.
And right now, the Georgia State Patrol Commissioner, Mark McDonough, had this to say to Atlanta commuters.
I would suggest to keep it simple, stupid in your life. Get an alternate plan. Get a backup to that plan and give yourself more time. You're going to have to get up earlier. You're going to have to adjust to the new norm until this is done.
So the new norm, we'll see. I mean, as you say, it's school vacation week, so maybe not as bad, but that'll be over by next week.
Correct. Yeah. And the real thing about Atlanta traffic is not so much that it's always dependably bad, but that it's kind of unpredictable. You know, one thing is commuting to work, but you have to think, hey, what if I want to run out to the store to pick up, you know, a gallon of milk or something? Is it going to turn a trip that might have been 10 minutes all of a sudden into a half hour ordeal? So it's thrown a little bit more unpredictability in Atlanta traffic.
That's Sam Whitehead from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting joining us from Atlanta. Sam, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Chinese President Xi Jinping will be in the United States this week for his first face-to-face meeting with President Trump. Lots on the agenda, including North Korea, but also perhaps a common interest of the United States and China. That would be Africa. Both China and the U.S. have invested heavily in emerging markets across the continent in recent years, seeking economic opportunities and maybe even geopolitical advantages. Joining us now is Aubrey Ruby, an Africa investment advisor and a visiting fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. She's co-author of the book, The Next Africa, An Emerging Continent Becomes a Global Powerhouse. And Aubrey Ruby, the population of Africa is rapidly increasing. It's 1.2 billion today, but the UN estimates it will double to 2.4 billion by 2050. Why such a population boom in Africa?
Well, it's a population boom similar that we saw in Asia. It's just delayed about two, three decades. And, you know, it's a very young population. So of those billion-plus people, 70% of them are under the age of 30. And the population growth rate hasn't fallen at the same rate we've seen in other places. So still in parts of Nigeria, it's common for a woman to have, on average, five children.
Hmm. And I imagine that many of the children who are going to be born in Africa over the next few decades are going to be born into poverty.
Yes, poverty rates are high still, but they've been decreasing steadily. Despite all the headlines, there are some good points of news in the world. And one of them is that, you know, a lot of those children who once would have died in infancy now make it a full life. And so that's another reason why that population is so large, is that the health statistics are improving and actually poverty is reducing. The question we have to ask ourselves is poverty reducing fast enough?
Hmm. And where is the growth likely to be concentrated?
Currently, the countries growing fastest on the continent are in East Africa. So you see Ethiopia, Kenya, and Rwanda still growing around 6 to 8%. We've seen a slowdown in growth in West Africa. Nigeria is just completing a fourth quarter of recession. And that's because in part of the commodity price slowdown that we've seen globally.
So which countries are poised to lead the Africa of the future?
Well, there's no doubt that Nigeria will be a major player because as you started this conversation with the demographic projections, Nigeria is going to be the largest by far. The population right now is around 180 million, but by 2050, it'll be larger than the United States, around 400 million. And so Nigeria, no doubt, cannot be ignored, even though the growth has been slowed this past year and a half. East Africa as well, when I say that, Ethiopia has about 95 million now, also a fast growth rate. And Kenya is steady, but both of them are experiencing significant growth because their economies are more diversified than you see in West Africa.
Okay, so that gives us a little bit of an overview of what is going on in some parts of Africa. But one thing that we know is happening in Africa is a dramatic amount of investment from China. Tell us what the Chinese are doing in Africa.
So, yes, Jeremy, I take somewhat issue with calling the Chinese interaction in Africa investment. So there is no doubt that China is Africa's largest trading partner. The trade has increased dramatically, and it's up to $200 billion. But when it comes to investment, the U.S. is still the largest investor from an FDI, a foreign direct investment perspective, larger than the Chinese.
But the Chinese are still doing a lot in Africa.
Correct. And most of that comes in the form of infrastructure. So, for example, the government of Ethiopia has a railroad that was just completed that goes between Djibouti and Addis, the capital of Ethiopia. That project was financed by the Chinese, but financed in an intergovernmental relationship. So between the Ethiopian government and the Chinese government, they worked out the financing, and then a Chinese contractor executed the projects.
And why do you not consider that investment?
Because then, at the same time, the government of Ethiopia paid for that project. So at the end of the day, they're the ones that borrowed the money from the Chinese, and then the money was paid to a Chinese contractor. So at the end of the day, it's the government of Ethiopia that invested in that. Just because a Chinese contractor did it, the world sees it as Chinese investment. And so I think it's important to recognize that part of the Chinese going out strategy that has included African markets has been centered around keeping a construction boom alive in China.
Has China, though, gained power as a result of some of the deals that it's done in Africa?
Certainly. You see growing, deepening relationships. Now, China's interaction in African countries is not new. It's kind of followed three main waves. You saw the 1960s period through the 1990s when there was kind of periodic ad hoc engagement, often around political agendas. But then post-2000, you saw a significant increase in trade, a ramping up to the $200 billion that we see today, plus these infrastructure projects. And now you're starting to see a more of a diversified approach. Now there are new Chinese companies, like, for example, in technology, like Tecno, making cheap smartphones, or Huawei, which is a competitor to, like, Ericsson. They're doing a lot on the continent on an FDI basis that's not a governmental project. But the influence that you see is most concentrated in countries with poor rule of law. So while the better the rule of law is in a country, the more U.S. or European investment will be in that country, Chinese commercial engagement does not follow that same pattern.
They'll invest anywhere it makes sense for them to invest, regardless of what's going on in that country.
Correct. So you see them heavily concentrated in countries like Angola, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, as I mentioned. And so as a percentage of those countries' investment and trade, China plays even a bigger role than in countries, say, like Kenya.
What about the United States? What are we doing in Africa right now?
Well, as I said earlier, the U.S. Is still a major investor. We American companies are putting projects all across the continent. You see, for example, I helped Procter & Gamble make a large investment in Nigeria to do diaper production because, as we said earlier, there's all those babies that need diapers. You see more and more U.S. companies getting interested. But they're interested in the world, and African countries stand in line. So you find some U.S. companies saying, well, we're behind in Brazil right now. African countries will start looking at in a few years. So it depends on the country and it depends on the sector, but U.S. companies are still quite active.
Are the African people, and I realize that is a really broad term to describe people in a lot of different parts of that continent, but are they being helped by this foreign investment?
So, sure. I think fundamentally, Africans have the same right as everyone on this planet, which is a right to dignified work and jobs. And so this investment creates jobs of a variety of forms. So U.S. companies are huge employers on the continent. If you look at Coca-Cola and GE and Procter & Gamble, they employ thousands, tens of thousands of Africans. And it's incumbent on all partners to try to figure out how to create the jobs for that next wave of young Africans, because the labor force of the future will be concentrated in African countries.
But I wonder also about how much exploitation there is by these foreign companies getting in there and maybe profiting at the expense of the people and the environment in Africa.
I think you see a differentiated approach between U.S. and Western European companies that are very concerned about things like sustainability and corporate social responsibility. You don't see as much attention to that among Chinese investors, but it's increasing. But African countries have more partners to choose from than ever. So it's not just the Chinese, it's not just the Americans or the Europeans who all have long histories in the region, but Turkish trade has increased dramatically, and India. India is getting more involved, and Indian companies are deeply engaged in East Africa.
Aubrey Ruby, as you look at Africa in 2017, you see war and drought causing famines in Somalia, South Sudan, political instability in some places, public health crises like HIV/AIDS and malaria, polio reemerged in Nigeria last year. Is that image of Africa accurate or just part of the larger picture? Or what would you say to people who, when they think of Africa, they think of all this disaster?
Yeah, the challenge we've had around understanding Africa and African markets in general has been that there's like a pundit's pendulum that we swing from, which is on one hand, we're always talking about Afro-apocalypse, all the things that you just discussed. And then a couple years ago, everyone was jazzed about Africa rising. And my message is that it's both. It's the same way that you can find at the height of Wall Street, a billionaire walking out of his office passing a homeless person. We, in every day in our lives, hold that kind of complexity in our minds. But then when we want to look across the ocean at an African market, we want it to be simple, all bad or all good. And it's neither and both. And so I look and I see young entrepreneurs who are raising Series A, Series B, Series C rounds out of Silicon Valley. I see tech platforms that are increasing and growing. You see an incredible formalization of informal markets that are producing mass opportunity for people. So in addition to all those bad things you see, there are so many good things happening across the region.
That's Aubrey Ruby, who's an Africa investment advisor and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. She's also co-author of the book, The Next Africa, An Emerging Continent Becomes a Global Powerhouse. Aubrey Ruby, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week, change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
This week is National Retirement Planning Week. Who knew? Because according to research, only about 60% of people in the U.S. have saved for retirement. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So that figure, just 60% of us are saving for retirement, comes from the Employee Benefit Research Institute. So for people who haven't yet started saving, what's your advice?
So I'm going to put on my CFP, Certified Financial Planning hat right now.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's really hard. You see startling statistics and it makes you freak out. And I really think about, well, people are just incapacitated. And like so many other difficult tasks, and it could be diet and it could be exercise, it really is easier to begin with just a teeny tiny goal. And so instead of saying, oh my God, I'm never going to do it, maybe just right now, if you don't participate in your employer plan, sign up and put 1, 2, maybe 3% of your salary away pre-tax, and it won't really hurt that much. Do one little thing to get started.
What about people who have started saving, but they're not sure if they're putting their money in the right place or putting in the right amount?
Well, I mean, look, generally speaking, the amount part is going to be dependent on what other things you have going on in your life. You're trying to put as much as you can into retirement. You know, I have these conversations with people all the time, and they say, well, you know, I can't because I have to save for my kids' college education. And my feeling about that is that your retirement really does have to come first. You can put up to $18,000 a year into an employer-based plan. That's an awful lot of money. One of the cool things that has happened with technology is there are some features in a lot of these plans, and even in your own IRA, where you can automatically escalate the amount of money that's going in. Again, as much as you can put these plans on autopilot, the better it will be for you in the long run.
Now, we often hear the warnings about if you want to take that money out of the retirement account early, you're going to pay a penalty and you're not going to have all that money that you saved to use. How often do people actually do that, take the money out early?
Yeah, this is called leakage, an unfortunate term, I know, diaper jokes aside. So when we look at some of the data, specifically, there's a big report out from the Center for Retirement Research up by you near at Boston College. And they found that about 30 to 40% of people who are leaving jobs just will cash out of their plans. Now, sometimes you say, oh, it's only $700 is in there. I'm just going to take the money. Well, you pay a penalty and you pay tax. And in many cases, you're getting half of that money, and that's it. So that's one form of leakage. Another is folks who are actually taking out loans against their retirement accounts. About a fifth of 401k participants with access to loans take them. Now, some of those people are fine. They're going to pay the money back. But if you lose your job at the wrong time, you may default on it. And about 10% of the folks who borrow against their 401ks default on it. And again, you're paying taxes, you're paying fees, that money vanishes. And the folks at Boston College say that leakages can reduce your wealth by 25% in retirement. So it's really something to be avoided.
And again, we're talking about retirement planning, even though Jill keeps using the term leakage. Jill
Thanks,
Schlesinger,
Jeremy.
Business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. Thanks so much, as always.
Take care.
It's Here and Now, broadcasting today from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. As we visit listeners here, many of them members of the military. In fact, this state is home to nearly 800,000 military veterans, many of whom know the trauma of war. Now, the U.S. government says up to 20% of U.S. vets who served in Iraq and Afghanistan came home with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's estimated that an average of 20 vets committed suicide every day in 2014. It's terrible, and it needs to be addressed. But there may be another part of this story. Psychologists at North Carolina State University have published new data in the journal Military Psychology that suggests veterans with PTSD are also more likely than those without it to experience something called post-traumatic growth. That means they could emerge from a traumatic experience in some ways better off than before. Joining us now is Jay Price, who covers the military for Here Now contributor WUNC. Hi, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we also know you have been in some of these places. You were a bureau chief for McClatchy News in Afghanistan, so you have been to some of these places along with the military. This is a tender topic, as you know. What prompted this study?
Well, you know, one of the researchers is married to a veteran, and he had deployed. And, you know, post-traumatic growth is real. But this researcher is Jessica Morgan, and, you know, she's at NC State, and she and another researcher decided to take this on.
Okay. Well, let's listen to a little of what she told you about this possibility that not everybody comes out of trauma worse off.
So essentially, post-traumatic growth is sort of this paradoxical experience where people report positive psychological changes following something that we would consider to be a very stressful experience. So it's not that the stressful experience itself is good, but that people are able to make meaning of it afterwards.
How did they figure this out? What did researchers do?
Well, you know, post-traumatic growth, like I said, is real. It's something that's been studied for years. In fact, a lot of the groundbreaking work has been done here in North Carolina at UNC Charlotte. And trauma is, you know, it's of course something civilians experience, since we're all susceptible to traumatic experiences. So a lot of the research has been done with civilians. But what Jessica and the other scientists who did the study did was they wanted to look at veterans, and they found that traumatic experience that shook your core beliefs about life, that, you know, the more likely it was that the more that it did that, the more likely you were to get something positive from it.
Oh, so it really had to be shaking. You spoke to a Marine vet who served in Fallujah in Iraq and in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. Intense combat. What did he tell you about how he grew personally because of his trauma?
Yeah, that's Richard Uranga, who's now a social worker. He does mental health counseling with children. He served three tours in some of the most dangerous places for Americans in those wars. His job was going on supply convoys as a driver or up in the machine gun turret of a truck, a relatively, you know, exposed position guarding them. And those convoys hit a lot of improvised bombs. Several would go off on the same mission sometimes at points. And it was so bad they started taking extra trucks, he said, on every convoy because they knew they would lose some. He has three kids now, and he says when he's spending time with them, you know, whatever they're doing, he's truly with them. Mm-hmm. He feels like his time is more valuable now, and how he and he feels more engaged with them and with the world generally. And here's him talking about how this feels.
Whereas when I'm sitting there, I'm kind of absorbing everything in. You know, I can hear the birds chirping. I can hear the wind blowing. I can, you know, see the people walking across the path. I can hear their footsteps. And I'm just paying attention to everything that's going on and just trying to soak everything in.
Look, Jay Price, I can hear, we got about a minute left, I can hear the people who haven't had this experience saying, well, what does this mean? What does it mean? Do researchers think, I know it's early days, but can they learn something from the people who have had this growth and apply it to the vets who haven't?
Well, one thing they found is they believe there's a correlation between people who can grab their own narrative about their traumatic events and you know, unbidden it comes to you sometimes. But what they're talking about is being able to conjure it up and think about it yourself and mull it over. And people mm-hmm. who do that are more likely to grow. And if they can enhance that, if they can bring that into, you know, as part of treatment, they might be able to improve lives for people who otherwise wouldn't experience this sort of growth.
Yeah. So control your own narrative. Look, we're going to link you to Jay Price's reporting on this because you are just, you know, piecing all of this research together. He covers the military for WUNC, and we'll put as much information as we can at hearnow.org. Jay, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, to the trauma of another war, the horrors of former prisoners who survived the death camps and ghettos of Europe after World War II were documented in dozens of recorded interviews by a psychologist from Chicago who visited and then recorded survivors. David Boder's recordings are among the earliest testimonies from Holocaust survivors. But long missing from this collection was a reel of songs just recently discovered at the University of Akron in Ohio. And David C. Barnett of Here Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports that this music tells a story you might not expect.
John Endres gingerly threads a thin silver strand of wire through a machine that will reproduce some sounds unheard for decades.
1, 2, 3. Testing. 1, 2, 3.
It runs much like a reel-to-reel tape player, if you remember those.
Endres is a media specialist at the University of Akron. He was part of a project to reconstruct a working wire playback machine and digitize some recordings made by psychologist David Boder over 70 years ago.
One of Boder's areas of interest was his work on the measurement of trauma.
That's David Baker. He's executive director of the university's Cummings Center for the History of Psychology. He says Boder got a grant in 1946 to interview Holocaust survivors. Those recordings were later copied and archived at the Cummings Center, the Library of Congress, and the National Holocaust Museum. But the collection wasn't complete.
Scholars were telling us that there was a missing reel. There was a reel of songs that were sung to Boder by Holocaust survivors after the war. And people were looking for that reel. We had a box of reels, and scholars would ask from time to time, do you know what's on those? And we had to say, no, we don't.
But now they do.
We are reproducing on this spool a set of songs that have been recorded at a colony of displaced persons.
David Baker says the recent discovery of this long missing reel of songs in the Cummings Center archives has sparked worldwide interest.
Ich bin in Polen. Ich heiße Gute Frank.
Two of the songs were sung by a woman named Gute Frank. One song they translated for us, Our Village is Burning.
Es brennt.
le bruit de refrain. In a day of the mistake will be friend.
She introduced this song to Boder, indicating the composer's daughter would sing this song in basements in the Krakow ghetto to inspire the people to rebel against and resist the Nazis. In singing the song, she changed the lyric from "Our village is burning" to "The Jewish people are burning."
For prisoners who had no means of writing down and preserving what was happening to them, they could sing songs about it to each other and pass the stories down in an oral tradition. University of Sydney researcher Joseph Toltz studies the music of the Holocaust, and in this specialized field, he's heard it all.
This was taken up and became a beloved song that traveled around the entire Yiddish-speaking world, even into America and other places.
Toltz is particularly impressed with the clarity of the Akron recordings.
This is a technology that is 60, 70 years old and completely outdated, and that they've done it in such a way that has brought a completely new quality to the sound that is sort of trapped in these wire recorders.
Cummings Center Director David Baker says it was a powerful experience to finally hear these sounds.
It's a bit like hearing the voice of a ghost. Here are voices that have been silent for 70 years, and all of a sudden, they're singing, and they're singing to us.
And they're due to sing to an even larger audience. The plan is for the Boder recordings to be featured in a special exhibit when a new National Museum of Psychology opens on the Akron campus later this year. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett.
Elizabeth Gilbert's best-selling memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, about her spiritual journey in the wake of the breakup of her marriage, inspired many women to go on their own searches for fulfillment. Esme Oliver went on one, and her new novel, based on that experience, is a darker, more biting version of Eat, Pray, Love. It's about a woman on the verge of turning 40, newly single, who goes to Italy for 2 weeks of indulgence, a distraction from her unsatisfying life. We can't say the whole title of the book on air, so we'll call it Smoke, Drink, F. And Esme Oliver joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
So this story starts out with a kind of a rant about aging, about not being appreciated at work, not being fulfilled in a career, not having a solid relationship. Was it cathartic to write like that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that I was having a really hard time turning 40. I think a lot of women probably have a hard time turning 40. But in particular, I think I did because I felt like most parts of my life were in a state of disarray and not where I thought they should be at that age. So I think it was cathartic to write about it.
What is such a big deal about turning 40?
I think you feel like you're now entering middle age. When you're 30, and I had a hard time turning 32, you feel like you're losing your 20s, but you still have a lot of your youth. And I think when you hit 40, you feel like, I'm in middle age now. Things are slowing down. It's not going to be as much fun. I'm not as desirable. Those type of things.
What did you think your life would be like at 40?
I thought that I would be living a life like I had when I grew up. I thought I'd be living in a big house and have a husband and maybe a couple kids or a dog, a very successful career. I think we grew up believing that and that you could be anything and have everything. And I think that's where I saw my life at that age. And it just was not that way at all.
So you decide in this book to just go to Italy. And as the title says, smoke, drink, and blank.
I was very fortunate. I had a good friend who had a house in Todi, Italy, and he offered it to me and a girlfriend for 2 weeks for my 40th birthday. So I met her in the Atlanta airport where we were flying out together, and I just said, listen, I'm going to go to Italy, I'm going to smoke cigarettes, I'm going to drink wine, and I'm going to fling with a guy, and I'm going to write a story about it.
And you really did get to know this guy, Fernando is the name in the book, and stayed in touch with him afterwards.
Yes, I think when I went there, I just wanted it to be a fling. I really didn't want to know much about him. I didn't want to continue it. But when I got back to the States, we really missed each other and we resumed a relationship and, you know, kept in touch pretty significantly. And I did get to learn a lot about him when I was there and afterwards.
Well, and when you were there, just the way that you describe your relationship with him, it seems like it had reached a level very quickly. That was kind of unlike anything you had ever
had before. David Boder's recordings are among the earliest testimonies from Holocaust survivors.
Yeah, I felt very liberated
but
there.
But long missing from this collection
like
was a reel
really
of songs just
and
recently
was,
discovered
free spirit,
at the University of Akron in Ohio.
And more charming probably than any man I've ever met in my life.
And everybody thought you were crazy.
Yes, my parents in particular.
Yeah. Do you think the message, though, from this is that the escape from real life never really works?
I don't think so. I think that things did work out. It didn't work out with him, but he was an optimist and he inspired me to do a lot of things. I started my own business after he and I split up. I mean, I think that the escape, you know, did end up benefiting me in the end.
Well, Esme Oliver, there are a lot of eat, pray, love type stories out there, a lot of self-help books about fulfilling your dreams, finding happiness. Did you want this book to be a reaction to those?
I think I wanted my book to show something different, which was maybe not the happy ending that everybody hopes for. I don't want to spoil the book, but this person who I fell madly in love with disappeared on me. And I think this has happened to a lot of women. And part of the reason I wrote the book was to help women get through that sort of heartbreak that I experienced.
One of the things that comes up in this book is the idea of ghosting. Which is when basically you're texting with somebody and they kind of fall off the face of the earth and don't respond anymore.
Right. And that's sort of what happened to me in this situation. And I think technology is partially to blame for this. I see it happening to a lot of my girlfriends actually who are dating right now, this ghosting.
How does it feel to be on the other end of that?
Devastating. I think women in particular need closure and crave closure. I never got closure in my situation. And I think that that's one of the hardest things to deal with and somebody to abandon you for no apparent reason that you really loved.
So now that you have gotten past the age 40 barrier, how are things? Right. Would you give somebody who's 39 and turning 40 some advice at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no big deal to turn 40. I've had a great time in my 40s, and I don't think that everything has to be the way you think it has to be when you turn 40. I think that you should just sort of relish every decade that you have.
That's Esme Oliver, who is author of the memoir Smoke, Drink, F, we'll say. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How proud we are that we got through that interview without breaking any FCC rules. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It is Here and Now.